All right, welcome to LogicGate, episode number 4, where we're discussing the Star Wars TV show Andor on Disney Plus. I'm your host, Scott, and I'm joined by my two friends, Doug.
Hello.
And Jason.
Hey.
Hey. So, we are talking about Andor, season 1, episode 4, which was called... Oh, I didn't take notes on the name. What was the name of this episode? Anybody know?
Aldani.
Oh, that's right. So, the episode opens with...
Hold on just a sec before we start getting into, like, the scene by scene. Uh-huh. I just want to say, as a general theme, maybe this is just me, but it felt like the writing kind of fell off a little bit.
Really?
Just not a lot, but a little bit.
Oh, I disagree 100%, but we can go into that later.
Yeah, I thought this episode was a banger. Like, I wasn't expecting much. But this, well, let's get into it. I was pleasantly surprised by this episode.
Okay, all right.
I do have a few points actually from last time.
Ooh, any clarifications? Okay.
So, about droids and emotions.
Oh no! Oh god!
I looked into this. So yeah, there is a debate about whether droids, you know, have sentience. Because if they have sentience, they would be basically slaves, right? So, that's kind of something they've wrestled with. I guess in Solo, they kind of nodded to that with like a robot uprising, but I guess it doesn't go anywhere because that's a prequel from, you know, before like the original trilogy. So they still treat them like slaves, but basically so what I've found is, they can develop weird characteristics if their memory hasn't been wiped in a while. So, like, if they gain a bunch of memory, they start acting weird, you know, outside of their normal protocol. So, I mean, you could call that sentience, but...
So, what emotions are we talking about? You're talking about the B2 from last time where Marva tells him not to be afraid?
Yeah. I mean, they had that line. Marva says, "Don't be scared, B." You know, because the cops are going to interrogate him and try to get information. And
the only emotion that we've seen any droid, even C-3PO, elicit, or K-2SO for that matter, is fear. And I think fear is an emotion for self-preservation. And in a lot of science fiction I've read, that's what defines a being, an organism, whatever, as being sentient, is if it has the ability to acknowledge and advocate on its own behalf for self-preservation. That's what separates a sentient being from, say, you know, a rock.
I disagree. I mean, that's like a debate. That's like a major philosophical debate of what sentience is, and like, you know, that's not an easy way out, I don't think. And I think, you know, having fear helps droids have some survivability. So having like a fear reaction makes some sense just programming wise. It doesn't just come out of nowhere. Right. But basically, okay, like K2SO from Rogue One. He was an Imperial droid, and he was basically reprogrammed by the rebels to like fight on their side. So he didn't just like change his mind on his own.
Right.
So like this, I guess I just want to fight against the idea that these are sentient in the same way humans are, and they are. I like the original framing of the original trilogy where they're basically treated like appliances, like junky old things that have this technology that's kind of alien. We don't have this alien technology, but they're not people, right? If they were, then we would have a very ethical dilemma. Star Wars would be very unethical.
I understand where you're going with this, but none of that has come up in any Star Wars, and certainly not in Andor, which is a one throwaway line about B2 not being afraid.
Yeah, and it's stupid. So
okay, all right.
I had to. Yeah, I mean, we could go on for
we
more.
Can, we can have a whole podcast just on the... I mean, that's a huge theme in science fiction, is
yeah,
right?
Okay, so the other couple things from last time. Karn in IMDb only showed 3 episodes at the time, but now it shows 4. So it must be that like they don't have pre-hand knowledge of all of the actors and what they're going to be in. So
I made note of that.
Luthen being blind, I wasn't really watching for it, but I think it seems like at this point it would be a dumb twist if it was true. So
I'm pretty sure he's not blind.
Yeah.
But you never know.
Yeah. I mean, if he is blind at this point, I think it would be a dumb decision. So
The only reason we thought maybe he was blind because he had that cane, but I think we determined that it was some sort of weapon, which we still have yet to see. So.
Okay, I just wanted to address, some things. Okay.
Doug, you have anything to address?
I will reserve my right to address things at a later time.
Okay, fair enough. All right, so episode starts. Interior of Luthen's ship, and he advises the computer to go to Aldani. And the computer goes on autopilot and flies there. And which is a planet that we have not heard of yet. So we still have not heard of any planets that have been in the larger Star Wars universe, right? Everything we're talking about is all new planets to Andor thus far, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yes,
there's a good line where, because they just got out of that fight, and Luthen says to Cassian, he says, "You're bleeding on my floor. Fix your arm." And he like tosses him like a dirty towel or whatever. And he basically offers him a job stealing from the Empire. He says, "I'll give you 200,000 credits to steal from the Empire." And he says, his quote is, "Put a real stick in the eye of the Empire." He's trying to basically talk Cassian into coming and working for him. Instead of just being a low-level smuggler, he's like, "I'm going to offer you a job where you make a bunch of money, but more importantly, you have a chance to make a real difference." And when Cassian asks him what they want to steal, he says, "It's going to be the quarterly payroll for an entire Imperial sector." So it really kind of sets up their relationship that, last time we were talking about, does he want the box? Does he want, but clearly, I think he even says here, he was like, "I came for the box. And if that's what I can, if that's all I can get, that's fine. But what I really want is you." He wants Cassian to work for him.
Yeah. There's some mixed signals in this episode of whether, like, how much Luthen actually likes Cassian or what he thinks of him, because like you said, he's like, you're bleeding on my floor. Here's a dirty rag. Oh, I searched the galaxy for you. I researched you, all your entire backstory." Later he references him to being expendable or replaceable or something. So
it's not clear how he knows anything about Cassian. Like, he's got his whole backstory, but as far as we know, Cassian's just some random smuggler, right?
Yeah, so, it's weird.
This is actually, I know this is very first scene, but this isn't the most egregious example of it, but this is where I kind of first got the feeling that the writing might have fallen off. Just a bit. Not much, just a bit. Because this scene is rather redundant. They already went through the back and forth in the warehouse of like, "Hey, I want you to come with me." "Oh, I don't trust you." "Well, hey, it looks like you don't have any other choice." That scenario has not changed.
Well, and yet no. They're
still arguing about, "Oh, I'm not sure I want to come with you." Like, "Well, you don't have any other choice." Like,
no.
We've already done that.
He does give him the option. He basically says, "You have 2 options. I can drop you off on a planet and you can keep running, or you can come work for me."
I understand that we still explore a couple more tiny facets and details of this arrangement, but for the bulk of it, it's already been illustrated. This is redundant exposition.
I disagree. I think the first argument is about them escaping and having Cassian trust him enough to even go on a ship with him and to leave the planet with him. The second argument is totally different. It's Luthen wanting him to do a job for him, a risky job, implicitly.
Not where it starts now, is it?
that's exactly what they're arguing about. And when the number of 200,000 credits comes up, Cassian actually changes his tune a little bit. I think that's the
important thing from this conversation is before, you know, you don't know, is Luthen going to kidnap him? Is he going to offer him, you know, a paltry sum? But he comes back with 200,000. I think that the conversation is to let the audience know that Luthen is serious. And we can get into it a little bit more in the episode because I think it's fleshed out, Luthen's character is fleshed out a little bit more. So let's.
I don't want to point to this as an egregious example of horrible exposition. That's not what I'm saying. But I am saying exposition went from being at like a 10 in the previous episodes to now it's like an 8.5. It's not perfect.
Well, if you
fair enough,
if you knew, it's actually Dan Gilroy who's writing these next three.
I was gonna get there.
Oh, you were getting there. Okay,
but yeah.
You're going to jump.
It's a different director and a different writer, but Gilroy is still the last name. So I'm assuming a brother.
Yeah, I did notice that. Yeah.
Yeah. He wrote Nightcrawler, which is a great movie. He's done a couple other good movies. He did one of the Bourne movies. He's not a slacker.
Is he like an 8.5 to Tony Gilroy's 10?
Oh my gosh, we're like 3 minutes into this episode and we're already like nitpicking.
One last thing I want to mention on this scene, which it is just about the price. They say 200,000 credits. This is an example of good writing, not necessarily in this episode, but the groundwork they've done. They've given you a relative figure here where like 700 credits was a lot to get off the island for a secret transport. This really special unit was 40K that was worth to him, everything to him. He was going to risk his life for it. We're talking about 200K, and I can like imagine his eyes widening when he hears that figure. Sure. Even though I'm not getting very much emotion from Cassian himself, but I'm like, so it's very nice to have these kind of relative figures, not just some numbers thrown out. So
I think that was what I took away from this conversation was the dollar figure, just to let him know that we're not. I'm serious.
I'll also point out, just wrapping this scene up, this is our first hint that Luthen can be a bit of a bully to try and just dominate his will to get what he wants. Because he does kind of intimidate Cassian at the end of it. You're bleeding on my floor. You know, clean yourself up.
Right, and that shows up later in the episode too. So, yeah.
Yeah, just
a little foreshadowing. All right, so the next scene. It cuts to Coruscant, and the label on the screen says Imperial Security Bureau.
I want to know for you, Baker, did you die a little inside when you saw Coruscant come up on the screen?
Well, no. I mean, I see where you're going with this because it ties back into the larger universe. Is that what you're going for?
Yeah, I think explicitly we were to all kind of talking about how we didn't want to see another thing set on Coruscant or Tatooine.
Well, this is when Jason and I recorded our Phantom Menace podcast. I had a little discussion. I want to talk about Coruscant a little bit because Coruscant, I have no problem with Coruscant because I love Coruscant. Because Coruscant is the center of the entire galaxy of the civilized galaxy, right? Coruscant is the New York City of the galaxy. It's where everything that's important happens. And you see a cool flyover of it in this, and it's just a really packed, dense planet. So I like seeing this because you did not actually in the original trilogy, it's referenced, Coruscant is referenced, but Lucas said a couple times that they in the 70s they just did not have the technology to have a scene with this big sprawling planet and all the things they wanted to do with it. So there is no Coruscant in the original trilogy. So when it shows up in Phantom Menace, it's actually in the Phantom Menace DVD commentary. He talks about what they wanted to do with Coruscant and how important Coruscant is to the galaxy. So seeing it again here, I did not have a problem with it because I'm a Coruscant fan. It's very brief. You only see a couple pieces of it. So, you know, they didn't go into the pieces of Coruscant that we already know about. You know, we didn't run into any Jedi. We didn't see any, you know, I don't know, any ships or.
I absolutely loved Coruscant in this show. I almost like feel like I've never seen Coruscant before because I blacked out everything from the prequels. Or at least they just had left no impression on me, like as far as what Coruscant was. It just felt like a big CG mess. And the interiors we saw were just sort of so fantastical and just surreal. It just didn't feel like a real place. So I am feeling like I'm seeing Coruscant for the first time in the show, and I'm loving it.
You don't see a ton of it here, so let's go into a little bit of it. So you see Coruscant, and it's, like I said, it says Imperial Security.
You see a lot of it. Sorry.
You don't... So it cuts to, like, the inside of what's essentially, like, a large boardroom, and there's all these corpos having a meeting, and you get the impression that it's, like, a weekly status meeting, because they're talking about, you know, what's the status of, you know, this sector, and, you know, how much are we charging to secure this, you know, so it's just, you know, they're given status updates. So the one thing I thought was...
I kind of got the impression this was like Imperial CIA.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that sounds about right for sure. Yeah. Well, okay.
The Imperial Security Bureau or whatever apparently is a very major like thing in the Star Wars universe. It's like one of the biggest security factions of the Empire, but there are like a lot. It's not like I think you're right. Like CIA, it's not like any part of the military. It's not part of like any of the armed forces. It's very, you know, information gathering and stuff like that.
They talk about that a little bit, and I wanted to read this quote from this scene. So he's trying to figure out like what exactly does the Imperial Security Bureau do, and I forget the lady's name.
Daedra.
What is it?
Daedra.
Daedra.
She gives like Mero.
She gives like a very textbook answer, you know, like, oh, we secure whatever and we provide peace kind of stuff. And the main guy, you know, whoever the boss is, he says, what's our purpose? Why are we here? And he has like this kind of long drawn out speech, which I thought was interesting. So the quote is, security is an illusion. You want security? Call the Navy. Launch a regiment of troopers. We are healthcare providers. We treat sickness. We identify symptoms. We locate germs, whether they arise from within or have come from the outside. The longer we wait to identify a disorder, the harder it is to treat the disease. So if we're looking at this from the point of view that this is the CIA, that is a really strange way to describe yourself.
As far as like the CIA goes, like
just as far as what do these people do? Like it was just like, he has like this holistic view of, you know, we're here to root out the, you know, germs of the galaxy essentially to.
Yeah. No, think of it in terms of like the CIA hunting out terrorist cells, you know, when they pop up, you gotta go hunt them and eradicate them.
Even monitor different communities that seem to be off world or like not fully controlled by the Empire. Maybe like, you know, monitor any sort of uprising that may be happening before it happens, you know.
Yeah. I just thought it was interesting. I mean, I don't think you go in the CIA, they talk about how they're healthcare providers. It works. I mean, it makes sense. I totally understand what he's saying and it makes for good TV. It was just kind of a weird thing, a weird comparison. So The scene ends with a brief discussion of the incident on Marlana, the incident being where Cassian killed those two cops, and just sort of catching everybody up that, hey, this has made it all the way essentially to the top, that there were two cops killed on Marlana.
Well, more about the Ferrix event, right, where the Marlana corpos had a disaster trying to apprehend them and lost some soldiers there like that. Right. This is the fallout of their incompetence. Yeah.
Yes. And it's made it all the way to the top. Like this is not a local matter anymore. Like now soldiers have lost their lives so that higher ups are involved.
Right.
So I'm going to probably irritate you guys. This is the second example in the episode of where I noticed the writing fell off a little.
Oh man.
The whole and again I come back to the exposition, that whole cliche of having someone in the group state, you know, our purpose is this, and then having the leader say, you're wrong, it's actually this. That's been done before. This is not an original way to explain it. And furthermore, everything up to this point has been really organic, really flowed naturally in the scene. And this is such a, we're going to halt the scene right here and just beat you over the head with, this is who we are, and this is what this organization's purpose is. Yes, they delivered it with flowery language, and kind of like before, I'm not going to say this was the worst example, but it was not up to the par of the first three episodes.
Okay.
Yeah, I take your point, Doug, but I personally absolutely loved this scene. Like, this, to me, was so awesome to see the inner workings of the Empire on a very kind of lower level. Like, this sort of bureaucratic,
right,
you know, corporate, very cold corporate, like a heightened corporate environment. You're seeing all of these yes men around this one, you know, major dude, and he's sort of shooting everyone down. Yes, we've seen this before, but the fact that it's not original is not going to like sway me in its quality. I think it's well written scene, and I think you're seeing something that you haven't seen before in the Star Wars universe, and it's put together really well.
You have not seen the bureaucracy that it takes to run an empire. And I think that's a little bit of what this is setting up. I don't want to dwell on this scene too much because we got like a lot more to go. We're going to be here all night.
I know. Yeah.
So we'll kick it up a notch here. So that scene ends, cuts back to Luthen's ship. Luthen tells Cassian, like, hey, you need to come up with essentially a code name because I can't go around calling you Cassian. That's going to be bad news. And Cassian chooses the nickname Clem, which I thought was, I don't know, I thought it was funny just because it was kind of...
Well, kind of a, I know what... Name. Do you want me to tell you what it is?
Oh, sure. What do you got?
It's his adopted father's name, who was hung. He talks about him being hung. I think it's actually mentioned in episode 3, but I had to look it up. Like, I had to figure that out. But yeah, Clem is a weird name, but it's kind of not really a disguise because it's he's connected to it. So
Cassian chooses the nickname Clem. And I thought the next thing I noted was that Cassian is on the ship and he's shaving, but he's shaving with his knife. Like, he doesn't have a razor or anything. So Cassian's shaving his face with his knife like a boss. I don't really know why he was shaving or why that had anything to do with the scene. I just thought it was funny. Mm-hmm. And then Luthen gives him a Kuati signet, Blue Kyber, Skystone, the ancient world, celebrates the uprising against the Rakatan invaders. Don't take less than 50,000 for it. I want it back. So he gives him like kind of like this necklace thing that's kind of like glowing blue for Cassian to use essentially to barter with.
The Kyber crystal.
Yeah, Kyber crystal is, I mean, that's what's in lightsabers, right?
As well as, doesn't the Empire mine that for like starship fuel or something?
Oh, I don't know. I did make a note that I was going to ask you guys about it, so.
Yeah, wasn't that what they were doing in Rogue One?
Yeah. Oh, was it? Oh, okay.
Yeah, I had no idea when he first said that, and I thought this was like a kind of iffy writing. Like, why would Cassian like accept his word that this is like a good down payment for 50,000 credits? Like, it this seemed kind of weak to me, but. Then I learned it. It's the like special crystal for lightsabers and stuff. So this is kind of weird because in a more mainstream like aimed show, they would like explain everything about this crystal. Oh,
right.
This is what lightsabers are made of. You really like this, you know? They would explain everything.
It's really rare. It's confused. Only mined on one planet. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So. I guess I'm conflicted about this, but yeah.
It doesn't really matter what it is. I mean, essentially what it is it's, you know, he could have given him gold, right? Here's something that's a down payment. It's worth a bunch of money.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, that's a quick scene. So the next scene you see is they've arrived at Aldani at this point. So Luthen gets off the ship and he meets up with his cohort, partner, whatever, and her name is Vel. And they land in this very, it's all outdoors. It's very forest. It's very wooded. It's very rural. And he's talking to Vel, and he basically tells her, like, hey, I brought you, another person for your crew. He says, he can pilot, he can shoot, he can lie. He speaks Alaran, Mayo, Nari. He's got steady nerves, and he isn't afraid to kill, and he can pilot, ! So he's really trying to convince this lady, like, you need Cassian. And Vel is super hesitant. She was like, look, man, we got a mission. We're shipping out in 3 days. Like, you can't give me a new guy. Like, this is going to mess everything up. I don't know who this is. I don't trust him. But Luthen tells her, he was like, look, I was planning on shutting you down. He was like, this mission isn't going to work out. So this is where Luthen asserts his dominance again. And he raises his voice, and he just basically shuts Vel down and says, basically, you're going to take him or we're going to abandon this mission. So Luthen is clearly the boss. And this is the scene where Luthen tells Vel later, or at the end of the scene, he basically says that Cassian is disposable, which I thought was interesting because, like, he just went to a lot of trouble and offered this guy a lot of money to just come to this lady and be like, yeah, I mean, I got you this new guy and you have to take him. But oh, by the way, he's disposable.
Yeah, yeah, this is part of the mixed signals that I was talking about. It's just kind of weird. But
I'm with you, actually, on that one, Nuge. And, I do find... Well, let me ask you, too. What's your overall opinion on her? Like, based on this first scene and your introduction to her as a character?
I thought she was a cool character, actually, because she's, you know, you get the impression that this is the early stage of, you know, some rebel activity, and she's very dedicated to her people and the cause. And I thought she was cool. I liked her.
I think she's a great character. You get to see her interact with Luthen, and then later you get to see her interact with her, like, squad.
Yeah.
And that kind of, like, juxtaposition is cool to see, like, you know, how they are treated or how they act around different people. I think she's a solid character. You kind of get a feel where she's coming from, and that's all you can ask for.
What do you think, Doug?
Yeah, I'll tell you a little bit later.
Okay. All right, so the next scene cuts back to Corpo headquarters, and we see that Karn and Mosk have both survived and made it back to, you know, their main base, and they're being chewed out by their boss. So my first thought was, I was kind of surprised. I'm like, how the heck did they get off the planet, man? Because that town was going to turn on them and, you know, have them drawn and quartered. But somehow they made it out. And their boss yells at them, and he says that because they failed in their mission to capture Cassian, his quote was, "You've rung the final bell on corporate independence. As of this morning, the Morlana system is under permanent imperial authority." So these guys screwed up so bad that the Empire is now involved, and they're like, all right, like, we're going to take over this planet because you guys suck so bad.
Yeah, this is hilarious. It's kind of funny. It's kind of a weird humor that we're getting from Star Wars. I want to note this, like, it's not like Marvel humor. It's almost Coen brothery humor. Like, it's shot very seriously. It's not shot in a way that says anything about this is funny, but the characters themselves are funny. Like, you see Linus kind of raise his hand, and then and the guy's like, shoots him down, you know?
Yeah.
You see, he talks about paperwork. They have to, like, sign a bunch of paperwork, and the boss is like, I didn't do anything. And
oh, right. Yeah.
He's like, well, that's the point. You didn't like actually do anything here. So anyway.
So there's not a whole lot in that scene, but you do. I think the big takeaway is that Morlana system is now under imperial authority. So
yeah.
Now whatever's going on Morlana is now, it's on the Empire's radar.
That was kind of my note from it, was like, imagine screwing up at work so bad that you got your whole planet fired.
Yeah, there you go. So the next scene cuts back to Clem and Vel. So Clem has gotten off of the ship, and Vel has decided to take him on as part of her squad. They're discussing the plan. There are 7 total people in her squad. As they're walking, you hear a TIE fighter, or they hear a TIE fighter coming, and they hide next to these rocks. So you see 2 TIE fighters fly over, so you realize that there is TIE fighter activity on this planet, and clearly they are hiding from it, even though they're way out in the middle of nowhere in this field or this rural farmland. And
I just want to say how awesome that was. I thought it was fucking amazing.
Just seeing TIE fighters?
Yeah, like... Oh, sorry! What?
A TIE fighter, that's all it takes?
Well, okay, so this is where I geek out, right? So I do love Star Wars as much as anybody.
Uh-huh.
And I like, you know, okay, so I love the fact that they've built this show out. They've done a lot with the foundation of the show, and they haven't put a bunch of fan service in my face. But then all of a sudden you hear that really familiar TIE fighter zooming past them, and like I was kind of listening on my big audio system, so it sounded amazing. It was really quick,
sure.
And it was just like a really nice jolt of fan service that got to me. So,
wow. Okay.
Hey, do I want to talk about this yet? I'll touch on it. I'll introduce the idea, but we don't have to dwell on this.
Mm-hmm.
There's a duality with Vel. Is that her name?
Mm-hmm.
Vel. That we see throughout all of her scenes. In that she tries to portray herself as tough and like she's the badass rebel girl, leader of the group and everything. But in actuality, repeatedly, you see she is not tough. She's frightened. She's scared and she's submissive. Her interaction with Luthen, she tried to talk tough to him. And then he raised his voice, and she backed down quick. She's trying to talk tough to Cassian, and then the TIE fighter comes. She's like, oh, shit, hide.
Hmm.
So there's an interesting duality at play with her, but it also touches to the point that Nooch brought up earlier, in that the writing is a little bit...
I was not touching on any bad writing. No. Okay, I'll clarify if you need, but I have not indicated that.
All right, so I will. Okay.
Do you want to talk about this more? Sorry, Doug. We have so much.
I know.
Time.
There's a lot left. There's
okay.
There's
another. We can get into it more later, but
I want to cover. So Vel says her line is that Aldani has the unfortunate quality of being close to nothing and not very far away from everything. It's the perfect hub for distribution. If one were trying to take over the galaxy. So clearly there's like some setup here that like Aldani is in the perfect spot for, you know, some potential shenanigans coming up. Which I think alludes to the fact that that's why there's some rebels on this planet. So the next couple scenes, there's like 3 real quick scenes. You see back on the interior of Lucent's ship, and he's landing on Coruscant, and you see him put on a wig and some fancy new clothes, like some purple, like some, you know, some shiny clothes. I'm going to go through these real quick, and then we'll talk about them. And then it cuts back to some high-up corpos are investigating Ferrix and the Starpath NS9 that had gone missing. So there's a black guy and the woman from we saw earlier, Lieutenant Miro, and there's some bureaucratic infighting about who has access to this report about what happened on Ferrix. And then it cuts back to Aldani. Yeah, it cuts back to Vel and her crew, and she's trying to convince them to take on Clem, you know, and they're just like she was. They're all hesitant about taking on a new guy so close to the end and somebody that they don't trust. So anything on those 3 super quick cuts that is worth noting?
You're getting a sense of Daedra. She's like, she realizes this Starpath unit may be one that was part of her jurisdiction, and she looks it up real quick and
yeah.
And she's trying to make it her deal. Like,
she basically wants access to this report so she can look into it more. And yeah, there's definitely some more. She's got a couple of lines later. Well, we'll get to it later, but yeah, it's just set up for why she's interested in this Starpath unit.
Yeah.
Okay. There was one note I had throughout that sequence. It's kind of a nitpicky thing, but why are the rebel guys using like real guns?
So that was my exact note. I said one of Vel's crew has what looks like a bolt action rifle ? Like, yeah. You've never seen anything other than laser guns in all of Star Wars, and that one guy looked like he had like a modified AK-47 or whatever, right?
I think a couple of them had like.
I only saw one, but I wasn't looking that close. I did make that note. I'm like, that is kind of weird that they have a real gun.
It felt...
A real gun?
Well,
it felt weird.
It did not look like a laser gun. That's all I'm saying.
Like, it's got a magazine cartridge, like, on it and everything. Blaster pistols and rifles don't have ammunition ports like that.
Huh, I guess I'm not a gun guy, but, I mean, I've played, like, Dark Forces, and a lot of those guns seem like, you know, AK-47s or whatever, but...
I mean, it may just be being picky, or maybe there's something more to it. It just sort of stood out to me, like, oh, that doesn't look like the normal sort of a Stormtrooper gun.
If it was an artistic choice, I think it was a poor artistic choice.
Yeah. So the one last scene, which I thought was really interesting, and I don't know how entirely, you know, essential this is to the plot, is you see Karn taking a long, slow walk of shame, and he gets to a door. And he rings the doorbell, and his mom answers, and then just slaps him. And then she lets him come in. So this...
Go ahead.
I don't know. I mean, one can assume that he got fired or demoted. Like, nothing was ever said on screen, and I don't know what, you know, his mom slapping. I don't know how that's related to the story. I just thought it was interesting that it's this long scene of him walking and you're like, what's he doing? And he's got luggage or he's got something he's carrying. You're like, where is this going? And he gets to this door and then his mom just comes out. She's like, slaps him.
Yeah. You get a lot from this, I think. I mean, you get the sense that this is kind of like a very smothering mom that's very concerned with her son's career. You get a sense of the sort of heightened just situation on Coruscant or within the Empire. You know, it's like a huge deal that he was obviously he's fired, like, right? He's canned. I don't know. I'm pretty sure.
I just think that, again, maybe there's more to it, but like they could have just left it at them, you know, the two of them getting chewed out, you know, and now that Morlana is under Imperial.
Yeah, so
like,
they,
that was already established. Like him, his mom, you know, him being a disappointment to his mom doesn't seem like it adds a lot to the plot.
I mean, it's a bit manipulative, but it's obviously wanting you to start empathize with Karn in some way. Like it's starting to give you his perspective and his like, sort of like, you know, just an empathy aspect. Seeing his mom alone gives you more to that character in a way that's not just a baddie, right?
Yeah, and it's so nice that they delivered it in a way that we're so familiar with and comfortable with already, because it's freaking cliche. The whole opening up the door and, oh, she slaps him. She must be mad. Oh, but now she's hugging him because she loves him so much. We've seen that so many times. It wasn't original. I agree with Baker. This whole scene felt pointless.
Hard, Doug.
This was the point where I was like, the writing has definitely fallen off. And yes, this one was egregious to me. The whole thing felt so... I was not happy with this scene.
Okay.
All right.
So the next scene, we are now back on Coruscant. And you see the outside of a building. And Senator Mon Mothma arrives. And I was going to ask, so you see Mon Mothma in the original trilogy. She's clearly leading the rebels. Is it ever mentioned in the original trilogy that she was a senator?
I don't recall.
I don't remember her being a senator. So when they said that Senator Mon Mothma has arrived, I was like, oh, okay, that changes things. Because Mon Mothma then was clearly higher up in the government, right? Like Leia was just some random chick that got involved in the rebellion. Same thing with Luke, but Mon Mothma, who was leading it, like she was part of the government. So, Senator Mon Mothma, go ahead. Sorry.
What is the government at this point? Forgive me if I'm just not familiar enough with the Star Wars universe, but...
It's the Galactic Senate. I mean, that was basically what all the prequels were about.
No, because at the end of the whole prequel trilogy, didn't they suspend the Senate indefinitely and basically grant Palpatine dictatorial power, which is what led him to establish the Empire and then basically run everything? When did the Senate come back as being a thing?
Well, now you got me curious. It's been a while since I've seen the original trilogy.
Padme's whole line. So this is how democracy dies, to thunderous applause. Like, that was a big deal in that movie.
Well, that was in Phantom Menace, which I did recently watch. So, oh, okay. I mean, I think what they're saying is that, I mean, because Palpatine rises to power and takes over the government, but the government still exists. He takes over the Senate. It still exists, just like, you know, Hitler took over Germany, but I mean, they still had a government. They still had a hierarchy, right? So I imagine that Senator Mon Mothma, I mean, she still had a job as a senator, even if the government was essentially a sham. Maybe we'll see more. I don't know. So Senator, and I want to emphasize that just because I thought it was interesting. She arrives and Luthen greets her in this door. He greets her in this alternative persona. So now he's got his funky hair and he's got his fancy new clothes and he's extremely outgoing and charismatic. And so Mon Mothma walks into this kind of like weird, like gift shop / museum kind of thing. And he's talking up all these like ancient artifacts and he's trying to, you know, essentially sell her on, you know, a gift for her husband. And so her driver comes in with her, and Luthen's assistant shows the driver around. She says, do you want to come look at some, you know, because your boss is in the back looking at some stuff. Do you want to come look at some terribly interesting coins that just came in? He was like, no, I can't afford anything in here. And he's like, well, you can just come look. And so the assistant basically distracts the driver so that Mon Mothma and Luthen can talk. So Luthen gets Mon Mothma in the back room and they immediately change tone. They were very friendly and, you know, just like kind of a shopkeeper and a customer mentality before, but they get in the back room and everything gets super serious. And they talk about getting financing. It's not clear exactly what they're getting financing for, but Mon Mothma says it's a lot harder to get money because she's being watched a lot more. So Luthen and Mon Mothma are working together and they need funding for something. So I drew the conclusion that they're trying to organize and get funding for the rebellion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is essentially the start of the Rebel Alliance.
Yeah. And I got a really clear sense of like how kind of scrappy and desperate they are. Like,
yeah.
Specifically Luthen. The payroll that they're stealing, I assume that's just money. The fact that this mission, like, it just must not fail because they're so tight on funds. And Luthen has to bring in this guy, pay him 200,000 credits, right? This is money that they're tight on to pull this stuff together. So yeah, they're really desperate. This brought up another question to me at this point, like. Okay, so we know the Empire is bad, you know, ooh, bad Empire, but I would have liked to have seen in the show some more, like, examples or instances of the Empire being bad, like, actually some reason for all these people to act so desperately and, like, in secret, like, you have this camp
isn't that what the entire original trilogy is about, the Empire being terrible? I mean, isn't that kind of assumed? Yeah.
I mean, I would rather judge the show like within its own bounds.
Okay.
And I think you could, I think it needs that. And I think it's kind of using it as a crutch, the fact that we know the fact that Empire is bad, quote unquote bad. But I think the show needs sort of this balance of like, okay, there's a desperate rebellion. So far on the show, the Empire has just been kind of bureaucratic and like kind of these Keystone Cops on this like corporo offshoot. They really haven't shown themselves to be that bad, you know. So I'm not, I just if I was just walking into the show and I'd be wondering, like, what's the deal? Sure.
The Empire's kind of an a-hole, but not 100% a dick.
It's not worth starving yourself on Adani. Like, that whole group, they said they're starving because they barely have any food. And they're, like, so desperate to pull off this mission. I mean, these people are really desperate. So I need to see a motive. I need to see something, you know, on the opposite end of that gives those people reason to be that way, I think.
That's so right. I also pulled something else, not to change the subject a little, but I do agree with your point, Nuge. I do wish they would show the Empire in more of a show, don't tell type of way.
Has there been any, have they shown anything of the Empire in Andor?
Not much. And then Mon Mothma is like talking to her husband about like these political opponents that he invited later in this.
Yeah, well, that's this dinner. Yeah, right.
But
yeah,
she indicates like, oh, these people hate me. They cut off shipping lanes to something and many will starve. And like, okay, that's bad. But like, that's kind of just like the U.S. does on many countries. Like, that's kind of the equivalent. So I'd like to see something more.
What did you think of the writing in this scene, Doug? Because I actually really liked the writing in this scene because there's so many things that are implied and it makes a lot more sense if you understand the larger Star Wars universe. But like nothing is explicitly said, right? They talk about getting financing. They talk about, you know, how she's being watched more. I thought that was a really interesting way to advance the story without spoon-feeding it to the audience.
One of the biggest questions to me in the series up to this point is, who is Luthen? Who is he? What's his motivation? Why is he doing what he's doing? Like, and this scene was really interesting to me as far as a Luthen scene, because he's bullied everyone he's kind of met. Like, he's just sort of intimidated them with his presence. Not her. If anything, he treats her as an equal, I would say.
Yeah, I got that impression too, is that they're
doesn't try and partners. Bully that. Yeah. So, but that being said, he's an equal to this senator who, I mean, if we know something about the Star Wars universe, we know that she's very significant in starting up the whole rebellion. But
I got the impression like that, I mean, again, and nothing has been said, we haven't seen it yet, is that Mon Mothma is the legitimate political arm of the rebellion. And like Luthen is the guy that goes out and breaks kneecaps. Like, he's her enforcer, kind of.
We're seeing some spycraft too.
Yeah, here. For sure. Like
the whole, you know, costume and disguise and the cloak and dagger and having the assistant distract the guard or driver, I mean. But
yeah, the whole part where the assistant just distracts the driver, that was totally unnecessary. Like, it was great. I loved it. It really kind of set the scene, but it didn't need to be done. They could have gone into the back and just said the driver couldn't have heard him. But it was just like that, just that little tiny bit extra to make it a little bit more realistic.
So yeah, no, as far as this scene goes, I did like it. I thought this was pretty well done overall, and it revealed just a tiny bit more about Luthen and who he is.
So the one other note that I had, and that the scene ends with Mon Mothma wanting to bring one more person into the circle. She says she wants to get somebody else involved, and Luthen hesitates. He was like, whoa, I don't know if I want to get any more. I don't know if I want to get anybody else involved.
And isn't that an interesting parallel to just before he was trying to shove someone else into girl's circle? And
so I don't think we know yet. I mean, we don't fully know what Mon Mothma and Luthen's relationship is, but Mon Mothma wants to expand whatever they have going on and bring somebody else into it. So I guess that's just one of those things we'll have to wait and see.
Do you have any, like, idea?
I mean, the only person that seems logical at all would be Leia, but that's, like, such a, like, that's way in the future. I don't know. Yeah. I guess we'll see.
If it's Leia or Luke or R2-D2 or Chewbacca, I'm just going to be pissed.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like, if they just want to mention it, like, yeah, it doesn't need to be a major part of the agreed. So the next scene cuts back to Vel's camp, and a new guy shows up, and his name is Lieutenant Gorn, and you get the impression that he works for, I don't know who, I mean, he works for the military that's on this planet. They ask him about the TIE fighters, like, do we have to worry about any more TIE fighters? And he said, no, they were just doing, you know, I've got them working somewhere else, so you don't have to worry about hiding from TIE fighters. But he shows up and he's in essentially a military uniform, and they tell him that they need his belt and gloves for a disguise. I assume that they're talking about for Clem. So they do have some, they have their fingers in the military a little bit on Aldani.
They got their inside man, baby.
That's
what you need for an Ocean's 11 heist.
Yeah, so now here is where the whole heist thing starts up. So the team, the squad, what are we going to call them? The squad, they go over a mock-up of the heist that they're planning on. So you start to hear a little bit about what Cassian's going to get paid $200,000 for. And I did think it was funny. There was a little bit of comic relief in this scene. There was a younger kid. So they have a model of, you know, what they're going to be doing on this heist, and this younger kid has built the model, because one of them goes to lift it up, and he says, no, I'll do that, because the rain gets in the glue. You know, he's worried about this model that he's built, and then, like, they're explaining the heist, and he says, well, obviously it's not to scale, you know, so he's, like, defending this little, they're out in the middle of nowhere, like, they're living in huts and sleeping on rocks, and he's worried about his model, you know, how accurate it is for this heist they're going to pull.
Yeah, Nemec is his name, yeah.
Nemec, okay.
Did anybody else kind of pick up on some vibes of, like, her crew is, like, the crew of the Nebuchadnezzar from The Matrix?
I absolutely got that, because I totally thought that kid was, like, Mouse.
Exactly, okay, yeah. Not just me. Thank you.
Yeah, if he came out and he was like, yeah, watch out for the woman in the red dress, I would have been like, yeah, I gotcha. So they go on to explain that they are going to break into this, you know, base and steal, whatever it was. It was the quarterly payroll for an entire Imperial sector. So they're going to break in and break into this garrison and steal this money. But apparently it's an insanely impossible run. And there are only 40 men in the garrison to defend it, because it's so insane that nobody would ever even try and break in. So it's going to be whatever. There's 8 of them now. It's going to be 8 versus 40 guys in this garrison.
Yep.
So they're going to break in, and Cassian says they're going to escape in, and I forget what kind of freighter it was, but they're going to escape in essentially what's this really slow, like, big rig. Like, you're going to, you know, bomb this place, and then you're going to have 40 people and TIE fighters chasing you. Like, how are you going to get away? Because, like, you're not going to get away in a slow freighter. And so they're going to use a distraction. So there's a once, I don't know, how often was it? What did he say? Once every 30 years or once a year, whatever.
A few years, like every 3 years.
There you go, every 3 years. There's a celestial event, and it's described as, imagine 50 meteor showers all at once, but like a curtain being pulled across the sky until the eye, the window to the galaxy, forms over the horizon. So their plan is to go in during this big event and use this celestial event to cover their tracks as they're flying away, because it's just going to be so insane that they pull this event off. And whatever this celestial event is a big deal to the populace of the city. You know, I feel like it's kind of like 4th of July or Christmas. Like, everybody's going to be celebrating this. So there should be less attention on this garrison during the heist.
Yeah. Amazing setup. I'm sorry. I got to say, like, okay, so this heist, right? And it's impossible. It's a suicide mission, quote unquote.
Yep.
So, like, impossible mission, so to speak. And these people think they can pull it off because of this meteor shower of billions of crystals, like, exploding in the sky or whatever. as a distraction. This seems like a very desperate mission,
mm-hmm.
but has a lot of potential. So I'm just super excited. Like, it's a great setup, I think.
You had me on board as soon as they started talking about heist, man. I'm a sucker for a good heist movie.
Yeah, so am I. I love it. Yeah, I do.
Son of a bitch, I'm in.
Nice. So the next scene is the interior of Mon Mothma's fancy apartment. And there's a big table, and it's set up for a big dinner party, and Mon Mothma walks in. And she meets her husband. Her husband's name is Perrin. And I don't think Mon Mothma knew, but she was like, oh, essentially, are we having a party? You're like, what's going on? And then he explains that they're going to have a dinner party, and he's invited a bunch of people over, you know, because you get the impression that Mon Mothma and her husband are kind of high muckety mucks, and, you know, they have dinner parties and they grease palms and get things done because they're high up politicians. Mon Mothma looks at icing the seating chart, I think, and she realizes that her husband has invited several of her political opponents. She says, oh my gosh, I can't believe you invited, you know, so-and-so. And her quote was, they spend every day trying to undo anything that I've touched. Don't seat them near me. And he says, don't worry, I put you down on you with the boring end of the table. This is the interesting end of the table. So that there's very much like, obviously, this political intrigue, you know, like that he's invited her political opponents, you know, because, you know, like it or not, you know, you got to at least be willing to work with people. But Mon Mothma was clearly not happy about that. And I thought it was interesting that, and I don't think it was related specifically just to this scene, but I got the impression that Mon Mothma and her husband just don't get along at all.
So, like they're. Yes, I picked up on that too. But let me ask you this question, because this is something that frustrated me with this scene. Do they respect each other?
I think they do. I got very much like Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton vibes. Like, they're high up muckety mucks. They know the score. Like, you do your thing, I'll do my thing. You know, that I got the impression that they did. Do you not think they did?
Well, I felt like there was a lot of contradictory, like, pieces in mm-hmm. this scene. He surprises her with the dinner party. You're thinking, oh wow, that. What a jerk move, you know?
Right.
But then he's like, oh, but I talked to you about it a month ago. So, okay. He was respectful enough to bring it up with her, like, and discuss it with her beforehand. And she didn't remember it. Is that because she's busy? Is that because she doesn't listen to him? In any case, she looks at the seating chart, finds out, hey, there's a bunch of people on the list that I don't like. Again, kind of seems like a disrespectful move, like for him to just throw that dig at her, like, I'm going to bring in all your political opponents who hate you, you know, enjoy having dinner with them. Seems kind of disrespectful. And then he points out, I sat you at the other end of the table, away from them, a respectful gesture. Like, what's the...
There's a whole lot of back and forth.
This is amazing. Like, I think you're confused, but I think this is such a good example of writing something that's not hitting you over the head with like a specific, oh, here's exactly what's going on. But this is so relatable. Like you get the
like that freaking Old Spice commercial with the diamonds and the I'm on a horse. Like
what?
It didn't make sense to me. It was all over the place.
Okay. What do you take away from this scene? I think there's really only one thing to take away, and that's that Mon Mothma and her husband don't get along. There's not a lot else explained, right?
Well, there's a political environment.
Yeah.
And let's just dig into this. Okay, so there's a political environment in this era where even family members are fighting. Some people... some are wanting to, you know, fight against it and like take things seriously and view certain political people as, you know, bad and don't want to interact with them. And then you have some people that maybe just want to have fun and don't really, you know, care about the situations. And don't even live in the same world of their viewpoint of the current political environment, but yet they're married to each other. And like, so I think this is fairly relatable in, and it almost passed me by until you described it just now, like the fact that they're so politically different, yet they're related, you know, this happens all the time. And this is something that we live through right now, I think.
Well, I mean, this could be true of anybody's marriage, right? I mean, I love my wife. We get along great, but there are certainly a lot, you know, things we disagree on, you know, like.
Yeah. Or, you know, if family members that you have dinners with and like.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, it's just, yeah, it's very relatable. And, you know, I didn't even realize that was what they were going at, but I think.
I hope there's more of these characters of Mon Mothma and her husband, because I feel like this is an introduction and there's going to be more, because it was a very interesting dynamic. And, you know, if he never comes back, it's going to be a waste of a scene because there was not a whole lot else here. The one thing that I did note that I thought was interesting was at one point he says, "Oh, I heard you brought me a gift." And she says, because, you know, she went to meet Luthen and under the guise that she was buying a gift for her husband. And she says, "Oh, don't worry, it's going back." Because Luthen had said, you know, if your husband doesn't like it, you can always bring it back. So this whole thing is all just a big joke, right? Or a big in-joke, but that he was like, "Oh, what was the present you got me?" And she doesn't even tell him what it is or offer it to him. She's like, "Don't worry, I'm taking it back." Just because she's kicked at him for having this dinner party.
Yeah, and he says, like, "Oh, can't we just have fun? Like, you know, can't things be just fun or whatever?" Yeah. And, well, meanwhile, she's, like, organizing a rebellion.
Yeah, right. So, we got, like, two scenes left. The second to last scene, we are back, and the Corpos are debating jurisdiction again. So, Lieutenant Miro really wants to investigate the theft of the Starpath NS9 unit. They're arguing over, you know, whether or not she should have access to this report about what happened on Ferrix. And the main guy, her boss, that she's essentially trying to convince that she should have access to this report, says, "This seems like a case of a robbery gone awry." And this is kind of like the second time we've heard this about these two cops that were killed. Like, why are we looking into this? Like, don't worry about this. Like, it's not a big deal. Like, why are you so dog on a bone about this? And she replies, she says, "Sir, it is my feeling that as part of an ongoing effort to steal proprietary Imperial equipment in anticipation of an organized rebellion, I have 3 previous case files on my desk that begin to suggest a pattern." So you start to see that the theft of this Starpath unit may be part of something bigger. So I wrote "beginnings of the rebellion, ! So you really start to see that, hey, there's clearly something's going on, because we know what ends up happening in the original trilogy, and that maybe this is the start of it, and that perhaps she has picked up on this, but the bureaucracy that is the Empire, they're not interested in looking into it. Like, this is small potatoes. And maybe that's where this is leading, is that that's how the rebellion gets its foothold, is that they just never take it seriously, even though it's staring them in the face that there's going to be a rebellion and that there's going to be problems, but the Empire is just too big, too bureaucratic to even care.
And too confident. They're overconfident, yes. As Cassian described before, they're fat and happy. Yeah, it's the same kind of thing, and yeah.
So, it's definitely interesting how they propose that notion of, like, oh, look, she's tracking the crimes, and this is the very, very start of the rebellion. Except we know that's not true. We know Cassian stole the Starpath unit. We know he has absolutely nothing to do with the rebellion at the point that he stole it. Her gut instinct, as she puts it, is wrong.
Oh, I disagree. But I think
she's right.
No, yeah, I think
she will eventually be right, but based on the facts that we know, she's thinking that Starpath unit is going to the rebellion. No, it wasn't. It was going to some smuggler who just wanted to make a quick buck.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, she noted other like activity, I guess, and it wasn't just about the Starpath unit.
There were 3 case files. Cassian was one of them. Although she doesn't know it was Cassian, but that Starpath unit was one.
I think you could argue that Cassian having the Starpath unit, like, clearly there's going to be a limited market for people that want a Starpath unit. so that if, you know, even if some Joe Blow was stole it, the odds of it ending up in the hands of somebody that wanted to do something bad with it, i.e. the rebellion, is pretty good. Like, or you got a low level grunt that stole it. What's that?
Or a bunch of smugglers.
Yeah.
I mean, that would certainly have a black market appeal, not sure. for any sort of organized resistance, but just black market smuggling.
I just wholeheartedly disagree with you here, Doug. I think the purpose of this scene is to show that Daedra, Mira, is like trying to plead with her superiors. She's right. We know she's right about the rebellion, maybe not in the specifics, but the rebellion or the Empire bigwigs pass her by and kind of ignore her in their own hubris. That's clearly what's happening here. And she uses the term gut instinct. You know, first she uses the term feeling, then she changes it to gut instinct because she's trying to make it less, you know, her language.
I think she sees some sort of pattern that, hey, maybe these three things are related. There could be something here. We don't know for sure. And it's worth looking into. And I just want to end on this because she tries again to convince him, like, please give me access to the report. I really want to look into it. And she gets shot down, and her boss says, talking about the guy that wrote the report that won't give her access to it, he says, his quarterly reports, however, are in, and yours are not. And here we are spending your valuable time with this issue. So again, you see the bureaucracy where he's like, look, I know you want access to the report, but he's like, look, you got other stuff that you need to be working on. This is small potatoes. So I think this is the hubris of the Empire of like, there's nothing here. This is a big nothing burger. Like, go fill out your TPS reports and tell me when you're done kind of thing.
Precisely. I think, yeah, you're right. You got that right.
And we'll see. I mean, we'll see how far down this rabbit hole we go. So, I mean, time will tell. We got what? This is episode 4. We got 8 more in this season. So the last scene is where we circle back to Vel's group, and they are sitting around a campfire, and the one of Vel's teammates, one of the squad, gives Clem an iPad with some ship specs and some Aldonian phrases on it to learn. And basically, Vel says, okay, you have until the morning to learn, you know, basically get yourself up to speed on all the stuff we're going to need for this heist.
Yeah, he plugs him into the ship's computer and teaches him kung fu. Oh, wait, sorry, wrong crew.
The only thing I had to note was it's like the lowest tech iPad I've ever seen. Like, yeah. He hands him this iPad and like the screen, like, you know, it looked like one of those iPads you'd give a kid that has like 2 inches of padding on every side in case the kid drops it.
Yes, the Fisher Price iPad.
Yeah, maybe I'm just jaded, you know, because technology is so small and there's no bezels on anything anymore. But he hands him like this ancient iPad. So, that was it. And then we see credits, and that's the end of episode 4. Anything we didn't cover?
I'm sure I could probably go another hour arguing back and forth with Nuge, but we're probably at a good stopping point.
We want to do ratings. What do you rate the episode?
Well, I don't know about the ratings thing. We, you know, it's kind of getting awkward. But
give it a number.
Pick a number.
Okay. Let me go over overall. I love this episode. Okay.
I did too.
On a scale amazing. Of 1 to 10, how much did you love this?
Okay. So we were introduced with so much new crap to this episode, right? Yep. I mean, we need to acknowledge mm-hmm. that. Like, this is so many new characters, an entirely new situation. We just fucked off with the whole other planet, other characters. But yet it didn't feel like it was overwhelming. It felt really kind of natural.
Mm-hmm.
It was very easy to take in and know what's going on. So you got to give it props for that. And the groundwork it laid helped build the situation that we're in currently. I love the heist plot. Okay, fine. 10 out of 10. Okay, we're done.
Wow. 10 out of 10. Wow.
Doug?
I don't think it was quite as high as a 10 out of 10. I introduced the whole episode with the subject that I felt like the writing fell off. Not a lot.
Yeah.
But definitely a noticeable amount. I do agree with Nuge in the sense that they had a lot to try and introduce. Like, the whole story has just completely shifted. New characters, new locations, new settings, new motivations, everything. So that in and of itself is a monumental challenge. Do I feel like they did a decent job at that? Yes. Do I feel like they did a great job at that? No. Some of it felt a bit cliche. But number-wise, I'm going to give it 7 out of 10.
I'm a big fan of the world building, and I'm an even bigger fan of the Star Wars world. And I think I've said this before, that I don't care about Star Wars characters. I don't care about Luke or Chewbacca or Han Solo, but I love the world that they exist in, and I love the politics and the interactions between, you know, the factions. So that said, that was this episode, start to finish, was all world building, and it was all introduction to mostly new characters, some characters that we knew a little bit about. I mean, you've got your Mon Mothmas and some of that, but from a world building and a political intrigue point of view, I loved this episode, and I was not expecting to like it as much as I did, because the last episode was great. So when this episode came by, and there's largely not a whole lot of action in this, it was a lot of exposition and a lot of setup. So for me to like this episode as much as I did, I was kind of surprised, but I would give this episode 9 out of 10. Yeah, absolutely. It was great. And it's clearly setting up for a lot more cool things to come. So I am looking forward to it. So barring a couple, like you said, a couple of scenes that were a little weird, you know, Karn's mom slapping him and some of the slightly weird dialogue. Otherwise, I thought it was a banger. Loved it. 9 out of 10. Any right. Closing thoughts? All right. Nuge, wind us down.
Logic Gate out.